Welcome, Litigation Nation. I'm your host, Danessa Watkins, here with my co-host, Jack Sanker. As a reminder, this is the show where we do a roundup of the litigation and legal news that is making headlines across the country. So what do we have today, Jack?
There's a recent class action against luxury good maker Hermès for the alleged anti-competitive business practices regarding the sale of their much sought-after Birkin bags.
And I'm going to cover the recent bill that was signed into law in Florida that is the U.S.'s most restrictive social media ban to date, and also the U.S. Department of Justice's recent antitrust lawsuit filed against Apple, along with 16 states and the District of Columbia. Since we're doing a few antitrust cases, I thought it might be helpful for our viewers to just give a quick overview of what antitrust law is. So this area law applies to nearly all of the industries in the country. The purpose is to ensure that fair competition exists in the market and also to protect consumers. So we have laws like the Sherman Act that prohibit a variety of practices that would restrain trade, including price fixing, anti-competitive corporate mergers, and various predatory acts that are really designed to achieve or maintain monopoly power. So essentially, antitrust laws prevent companies from profiting by playing dirty. And the idea is that without these laws in place, consumers wouldn't have the choices that they do, and they would be forced to potentially pay higher prices in order to get the goods and services that they require. So oftentimes we have businesses that can sue another business for anti-competitive behavior, but the government may also step in at times to stop businesses from establishing monopolies. Here's what you need to know.
So with that primer on antitrust law generally, there's an interesting class action that was filed in the Northern District of California for violation of the Sherman Act and some state laws in California for unfair competition, things like that, against Hermès International, which is a maker of all sorts of luxury goods. But in this particular case, the Hermès Birkin bag. So some background if you don't know. Some luxury brands do this. It's happening more and more, really. Basically, retailers will straight up refuse to sell you a luxury good unless you demonstrate to the retailer what they call, quote, sales history. So basically, if you want to buy this rare luxury good, in this case, it's the famous Birkin bag from Hermès. Rolex also does this, and a lot of watch companies do as well. You'll get put on like a waiting list, which is basically forever, unless you have a sales history. And what that means practically is if you want to be able to buy this thing, this Birkin bag or this Rolex or whatever it is, you'll have to purchase from the retailer a bunch of other stuff first, which can then put you higher on this list and will give you the privilege of paying many thousands of dollars for the one thing that you do want. So put another way, you have to buy a bunch of other crap you may not actually want just to move up on the list. And this is, I know, kind of a first world problem. Don't get me wrong here. But that is what Hermès does for its Birkin bags. And it's an interesting case out of California that's worth talking about. According to my wife, Birkin bags can cost tens of thousands of dollars, but are totally worth it. They're allegedly really high quality, whatever. And here's what the plaintiffs describe happened to them in this when they attempted to buy the Hermès bags, the Birkin bags, in their complaint. So quoting from the complaint, Birkin handbags cannot be purchased from defendants through the Hermès website. Instead, consumers can only purchase Birkin handbags from defendants by physically going to a Hermès retail store. However, unlike most consumer products and most other products sold by defendants, and they're talking about Hermès there, consumers cannot simply walk into an Hermès retail store, pick out a Birkin handbag they want, and purchase it. Birkin handbags are never publicly displayed for sale at Hermès retail stores. Indeed, it is often the case that there are no Birkin handbags at all in Hermès retail stores, or if there are, there are only one, two, or at most three Birkin handbags. But even if there are Birkin handbags at the particular Hermès retail store, the handbags will not be displayed on the sales floor for the general public. In fact, most consumers will never be shown a Birkin handbag at the Hermès retail store. Typically, only those consumers who are deemed worthy of purchasing a Birkin handbag will be shown a Birkin handbag in a private room. The chosen consumer will be given the opportunity to purchase the specific Birkin handbag, which they are shown. Consumers cannot order a Birkin handbag at the retail location. For all practical purposes, there is no way to order a bag in the style, size, color, leather, and hardware that the consumer wants. Now, Hermès sales associates are tasked by defendants with selecting these consumers who are qualified to purchase Birkin handbags. The sales associates are directed by defendants to only offer Birkin handbags to consumers who have established a sufficient, complaint quotes here, purchase history or purchase profile with defendants or defendants' ancillary products such as shoes, belts, scarves, jewelry, and home goods. Only once a consumer has sufficient purchase history or purchase profile with defendants will the consumer be offered the opportunity to purchase a Birkin handbag, unquote. So, here's a pretty interesting part that I really didn't know, and this is the part that mostly implicates Hermès, the corporation. And this is regarding the structure of the compensation for Hermès salespeople in the actual stores. Quoting again from the complaint, quote, the commission rates paid by defendants to sales associates differ based on the type of product sold. Sales associates are paid 3% on ancillary products such as shoes, scarves, belts, jewelry, and home goods. They're paid 1.5% commission on non-Birkin handbags, and they receive no commission whatsoever on the sale of Birkin handbags. Although Hermès sales associates receive no commission on the most valuable and sought-after products sold by their employer, they are instructed by defendants to use Birkin handbags as a way to coerce consumers to purchase ancillary products sold by defendants for which the sales associates receive a 3% commission in order to build up the purchase history required to be offered a Birkin handbag. In this way, defendants are able to use their sales associates to implement defendants' illegal tying arrangement. So, let's pause here for a minute. What is a tying arrangement? What even, you know, really is the basis of this lawsuit? And a moment ago, you heard from Vanessa about the Sherman Act and broad strokes anti-monopoly and antitrust laws in the United States. This idea of a tying arrangement, it's T-Y-I-N-G. Going from the FTC website and my general knowledge about this, I'm not an antitrust lawyer. We do have some good ones at the firm, and I didn't get a chance to talk to them before recording today, but maybe we can have one of them on to explain this a little better than I can. I'll quote from a recent write-up on the definition of tying. Quote, for competitive purposes, a monopolist may use forced buying or tie-in sales to gain sales in other markets where it is not dominant and to make it more difficult for rivals in those markets to obtain sales. This may limit consumer choice for buyers wanting to purchase one, quote, tying product, by forcing them to also buy a second tied product as well. Typically, the tied product may be a less desirable one that the buyer might not purchase unless required to do so, or may prefer to get from a different seller. If the seller offering the tied product has sufficient market power in the tying product, these arrangements can violate antitrust laws, unquote. So the kind of crux of this Hermès case is that Hermès is engaged in a tying arrangement by forcing customers who want a Birkin bag to buy a bunch of less desirable but probably still expensive Hermès stuff first. Here, one of the plaintiffs alleges that she spent tens of thousands at Hermès and finally asked to be permitted to buy a Birkin bag, after which she was told the bags are limited only to, quote, clients who have been consistent in supporting our business, unquote, which is another way of saying you need to spend more money on other Hermès stuff before we'll sell you the Birkin.
So it's pretty vague then.
Seems like it's vague but also understood. You don't get to buy the Birkin unless you've dropped some amount.
A certain amount, but they don't specify what that amount is.
They won't tell you what it is, okay. Which probably keeps you buying.
Right, exactly.
And there's the whole sunk cost aspect of it. If you spend $5,000 and they tell you you only need to spend another $5,000, that's all you'll spend. But if they, you know, if they keep it vague, maybe you come in and spend $20,000 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And who are the plaintiffs in this suit?
People that wanted to buy Birkin bags and weren't allowed to.
Okay.
Yeah, interesting.
Because I could see the competitors bringing this suit also.
Yeah, you would think. Although I don't know if there is a competitor of...
Well,
for the scarcity level, I had to look... All right, I don't know anything about Hermès bags, okay? But I looked into it, and apparently they're like Sasquatch level rare. Like they don't exist, you know? It's like an urban myth. Like you can't get them.
Right.
And so to have one is an immense status symbol, and basically people will do anything to get them. But I think from Hermes' perspective, if they just, you know, price them in such a way that would be maybe the word would be gauche, you know, if it was like this leather bag is $400,000 or whatever, like that, you know, maybe that would be kind of tacky. Mm-hmm. But maybe the bag's $30,000 and they make you spend $100,000 to buy it, right? They're getting that margin on all of that spending without looking tacky. I don't know. I'm speculating, but so the plaintiffs in this case are alleging that Hermes is illegally tying the sale of their Birkin bags to other products through this payment structure of their salespeople, which I think is interesting because the salespeople are incentivized to push the other products, and really they're not incentivized to sell Birkin bags at all because they get no commission on it. But the only purpose of the Birkin bag then is to sell the less desirable stuff, scarves and shoes and whatnot. So there's certain claims for violation of California state laws. Then, of course, there's the Sherman Act claims. I think it's interesting because it's also very common for imported, you know, what you would call luxury cars and also luxury watches, too. So, like, if there's a dealership that happens to sell Lamborghinis, you know, they're not often just selling Lamborghinis. Maybe they're also selling Audis. Maybe they're also selling, you know, something else along those lines. And you walk in there and you're like, I want the, you know, a brand new Lamborghini. And they're like, well, no, you know, you have to buy two other cars from us first. You have to buy, like, you know, this Audi that's been on the lot for 18 months that we're trying to get rid of and something else before they'll even entertain the idea of selling you what it is. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that when it's coming from the manufacturer controls the price. So, like, you'll see this with Birkin bags, and of course you'll see this with Rolexes big time, and with, you know, if you were to resell a new Lamborghini or whatever, where the resale value after you actually get it in your hand is way higher than the MSRP. So, like, you know, a $10,000 watch from Rolex. Rolex tells their dealers you cannot sell this watch for more than $10,000, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, so we can only make X amount of dollars on it. But if you buy that watch from Rolex and then go put it up online, you could sell it for $20,000, like, because they're so hard to get. So I think the dealers are feeling like they're getting screwed on that margin because they can't just sell it at the market price. And I guess to claw back some of that, they're like making you buy a bunch of other stuff you didn't want. So Rolex dealership will make you buy, you know, two to three other items or some jewelry or whatever, just before they even sell you what you want.
That's interesting. I didn't even know that those practices existed. Clearly, I'm not buying the high-end Lamborghini.
I mean, I'm not either, but Rolex is notorious for this. But also, shoemakers, car dealers, anyone who's selling anything that's, like, collectible, this seems to be something that you're seeing more and more of. But what's unique in the Hermes case is that the tying is not being done by a third party. It's Hermes that's doing it. So, for example, if someone were to bring this case against, you know, say Rolex or certain luxury car dealers or whatever, Rolex and car manufacturers are using affiliated third-party sellers, like, so an authorized dealer or car dealership or whatever you want to call it. They're not being run by, like, Rolex company stores or, you know, or Lamborghini company stores or whatever. They're being run by, you know, this local dealer. So you can't, or I mean, maybe you could, but it would be hard to directly go after Rolex for the anti-competitive practices when it's really happening at the lower level distribution. Here, Hermes owns and runs all of these stores themselves. So if there is liability, it's going to be imputed directly onto, you know, Hermes proper corporation, not just, you know, the folks that are operating the local store. So it could theoretically, you know, be on the hook here. And, I mean, I'm not saying that you and I should head over to the Oak Street Hermes here in Chicago and ask for a Birkin bag just so that we can get turned down and join this class. I'm not saying anyone listening should do that either. It's an interesting case nonetheless, and applying this, the Sherman Act and some of the other anti-competitive statutes, both at the federal level and state level, to the way in which a lot of these luxury brands are operating today, you know, 130 years after these laws were passed, kind of does show you that, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. People are still doing the same things they were in the 1890s.
And I wonder for the plaintiffs in this case if they need to show a certain level of money already spent or, on certain products.
So, you know, they don't spell it out super well in the complaint, because that's what I was looking for too. But I do think that's what I would, claim. I'd be like, look, I didn't want this scarf or these shoes or whatever. I was being induced to buy them so that I could buy the Birkin bag, and now they won't sell me the bag. I've been damaged in the amount of money that I've spent, you know, or something along those lines, which I still think is kind of tenuous, because, like, you did pay for the shoes and you received the shoes, right? And to your point earlier, it is all it's all implicit. It's not spelled out. And so that may be difficult, although I think everyone knows the game here, and I think it's common enough in luxury dealers that everyone understands you don't even get to look at this stuff. Like, go to a Rolex dealer and you know, ask if they'll sell you, you know, a Submariner or whatever. They'll just, if they don't know you, they'll just laugh at you. They're like, absolutely not. Which is crazy, because even if you're like, I'll pay for the item, I'll pay it, they're just like, that's not where we make our money. We make our money on all the crap we make you purchase before we sell you the item. Right. So, yeah, it's it'll be interesting to see if this one sticks around. I don't know how big the class can be. I mean, how many people have gone through the trouble of building a sales history with Hermès to then be denied the Holy Grail Birkin bag? I mean, dozens, maybe, if that.
Hmm. And clearly there's an employee whistleblower that's giving all the inside information about
the commission aspect of it is what's very interesting. Which I think does imply that Hermès knows what's going on. It's not just, you know, the employees on the floor doing it.
Right. So, interesting. All right, so moving on to this antitrust suit against Apple. So on March 21st of 2024, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against Apple, along with 16 states and the District of Columbia, alleging that Apple is using anti-competitive practices in order to maintain its monopoly in the smartphone market. Now, the basic theory of this lawsuit is that Apple is squelching the development of apps. These so-called super apps that are essentially a gateway to a variety of other services and apps. So think cloud streaming, gaming apps, messaging apps, but particularly financial services such as digital wallets. That's a big one that came up in this lawsuit. And then accessories such as smartwatches and things of that nature. So the idea is that Apple is insulating the iPhone from the rise of potential competitors. Now, the DOJ is claiming that Apple's practices are intended to keep customers reliant on iPhones and less likely to switch to other devices. So I don't think it's any secret that the iPhone is certainly the most profitable product that Apple has put out. And just to give you a sense of that, in 2022, the App Store generated $104 billion in digital sales. All right, now some of the anti-competitive behaviors that the DOJ is alleging includes making it easier for users to connect iPhones to Apple products, such as smartwatches and laptops. Preventing the creation of digital wallet alternatives by limiting finance companies' access to the iPhone's payment chip and also Bluetooth trackers from tapping into its location service feature. There's also allegations of blocking cloud streaming apps and then undermining messaging across smartphone operating systems. So essentially, the claim is that Apple is creating this moat around its smartphone monopoly, which ends up resulting in higher prices and less innovation. Now, I found some quotes from a professor from the University of Virginia School of Law. This is Thomas B. Nackbar, and he weighed in on this lawsuit and the impact that it's going to have. So first, he started by finding some similarities between this case and the lawsuit that the government brought against Microsoft in the late 1990s. So in that case, the Department of Justice and 20 different states filed an antitrust claim against Microsoft to determine whether that company's bundling of additional programs into its operating system constituted monopolistic actions. Now, the initial ruling in that Microsoft case was that there were violations of the Sherman Act, and a district court ordered Microsoft to divide the company in half. certainly we know that didn't happen. Microsoft appealed and they ended up settling with the DOJ. So they didn't have to break up their company, but they did agree to share computing interfaces with other companies. So Professor Nakbar says, quote, "The Microsoft case itself offers a lot of guidance here. In that case, the court ruled that the plaintiff has to show that there is anti-competitive effect, and then the defendant has to provide a pro-competitive justification. Then, if the plaintiff can rebut that justification, the court should balance the pro-competitive and the anti-competitive effects. Much of the conduct the government is complaining of in this case," he's referring to the Apple case, "are things that Apple says it does in order to either protect its users or to provide them a distinctive customer experience. And those types of justifications were largely accepted by the court in the Microsoft case. So it will likely come down to the facts, how credible Apple's claims are that its conduct provides a distinct product or improved security. Credibility was a major problem for Microsoft in its case, with some very damning email traffic featuring prominently in the case," end quote. Now, what's interesting about what that professor notes from the Microsoft case is that in the Apple complaint, it's an 88-page complaint, but they start by giving quotes from what may turn out to be very damning emails between Apple executives. So this is quoting the first paragraph of the complaint. "In 2010, a top Apple executive emailed Apple's then CEO about an ad for the new Kindle e-reader. The ad began with a woman who was using her iPhone to buy and read books on the Kindle app. She then switches to an Android smartphone and continues to read her books using the same Kindle app. The executive wrote to Jobs, Steve Jobs. One, quote, message that can't be missed is that it is easy to switch from iPhone to Android, not fun to watch," end quote. Jobs was clear in his response. Apple would force developers to use its payment system to lock in both developers and users on its platform. Over many years, Apple has repeatedly responded to competitive threats like this one by making it harder or more expensive for its users and developers to leave than by making it more attractive for them to stay. And that's end quote from that first paragraph. So certainly the DOJ is starting out this complaint by showing or attempting to show a clear intent to create a monopoly by Apple's then CEO and the higher ups.
I think to interject here, just on the amount of money that Apple rakes in on this, from almost everyone, there's rumors of certain apps getting a special deal with Apple, but for almost everyone, it's a sliding scale of 15 to 30. But for small guys, you know, a small app or whatever, it's going to be on the lower end, I suppose. But then, like, the higher volume stuff, it can get higher up. But it is it's a sliding scale based on that. But point is, you know, if you have an app that is doing, you know, $10 million in sales or whatever, and you want it to be on the App Store, you have to be paying Apple between $1.5 and $3 million just to be on, for the privilege of being allowed on the App Store. So it's a serious amount of money from their perspective.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm sure that there are going to be a lot more stories like that, of situations where Apple has, or is raking in money because people know that iPhone is the most successful smartphone out there.
Yeah, I think Apple's justification, which we'll see in whatever they file in response to the DOJ complaint, it is typically been, we are interested in the privacy of our consumers' data and in protecting them from, you know, bad products or whatever. So, you know, I hate to say it, but the App Store experience and the apps that are on the App Store, there is a certain amount of trust that you can sort of have in those apps versus the more open, like, Android store, at least in my experience. But with that comes, you know, the amount of control that Apple has over, you know, how those apps are presented and everything else. But that's Apple's, typically their response is, you know, we're protecting our consumers against, you know, harmful downloads or whatever they want to call it. And whereas the competitors are saying, no, you're just, to your point, building a moat.
Right. And like Professor Nakbar said, it's ultimately going to come down to a judge having to weigh, what are these competitive behaviors versus the consumer protections that Apple says it's trying to put into place.
And I don't have the date offhand, but I do know, I think I remember this from law school, but the Microsoft case that you mentioned, I think lasted like 10 years.
Yeah, certainly. This isn't, and we know Apple's not going to just lay down and settle with the government on this one. I mean, they have a sizable business that they need to protect and that they're going to fight for. So I don't think we'll have any decisions in this case for a while, for a number of years. And even then, there could be appeals. But this is one that's probably going to set some real precedent going forward for antitrust law. And I read a few articles in particular that was saying that the government currently is putting a lot of money into research into potential monopolies and spending a lot on litigation against them too. So,
yeah, the problem is that Apple can. I mean, this is a blip on their radar in terms of expenses. You know, they can have hundreds of lawyers billing effectively 24 hours a day for the next 10 years and really not even feel it. You know,
yep.
And like eventually the DOJ will.
Yeah, certainly. And so it's funny, in looking into this story, I found an interesting article on Wired.com, which actually touched on the very reason that I personally switched to an iPhone, and that is the stigma of the green bubble.
Oh, yeah.
And this is actually addressed in the complaint. It says, Apple affirmatively undermines the quality of rival smartphones. So because messages sent between iPhones via Apple's proprietary network appear in blue bubbles, but those from Android phones appear in green and are excluded from any of the iMessage features, Apple has signaled to consumers that rival phones are of less quality, the suit alleges. And I have that too. You know, you're in a group chat you're turning the chat from blue to green, and
it's the scarlet letter of texting. Yeah,
absolutely.
The green bubble. You're just like, man, come on.
And of course, you know, you've got younger and younger consumers that are getting smartphones now. And we've talked on previous shows how peer pressure affects this generation differently. You know, the cohort of juveniles. So those types of things where you're going to have kids that you know, don't have the iPhone, they're going to feel more pressured and bug their parents more for the iPhone to get the blue bubbles. So it's just, you know, one of many issues that are raised in the complaint about why they think iPhone is engaging in this anti-competitive behavior. And then we found, actually it was Wired.com that also touched on some of the damning evidence that could potentially come out in this case. I'm quoting now from that article. So back in 2022, at the annual Code Conference, where tech luminaries submit to onstage interviews, an audience member asked Apple CEO Tim Cook for some tech support. Quote, I can't send my mom certain videos, end quote, he said. She used an Android device, which means she can't access Apple's iMessage. Cook's now infamous response, quote, buy your mom an iPhone, end quote.
There you go.
Yep. So it will be interesting to see how this case develops. I'm sure we're going to get a motion to dismiss filed by Apple in the next couple weeks or so. So we'll continue to follow up, and this could be years in the making.
A lot of content.
Absolutely. All right, now moving on to this new Florida law that Ron DeSantis just signed in. In a nutshell, this bill is set to take effect January 1st of 2025, and it will ban social media accounts for children under 14 in Florida. It also will require parental permission for 14 and 15-year-olds to use social media. Now, what's kind of interesting about this bill that just got passed is it's actually, well, probably not the second. I'm sure there's been a long line of them, but just a month ago, Governor DeSantis actually vetoed a bill that was similar, but it set the ban at 16. So there must have been some negotiations that were done behind the scenes, because at the time he vetoed it, he did say that a improved bill was coming out. And DeSantis has also said he would never sign into law a bill that he felt would not pass constitutional muster. So I guess the negotiations were giving some parental control back when it pertained to 14 and 15-year-olds who are accessing social media. So looking a little bit into what the law would prohibit and require. First, social media platforms have to prohibit minors under 14 from creating new accounts. It requires social media platforms to terminate certain accounts. It authorizes the state to issue and enforce civil investigation demands under certain circumstances, and also providing for civil penalties. And it will allow 14 and 15-year-olds to keep their accounts if a parent or guardian says it's okay. Now, this is somewhat similar to the laws that other states have tried to put through. We mentioned on a prior episode the CADCA that California tried to put in, which a district court recently held as unconstitutional, primarily based on First Amendment issues. That is up on appeal, so we will follow up on that. But certainly this new law probably is going to face the same scrutiny. That we have the same First Amendment concerns, really, that we're setting a hard line at 16 and limiting access to information for anyone under that. There's also questions about how can a social media company actually verify someone's age? Are we doing censorship and restricting access in a sweeping fashion that really isn't called for? Again, prior restraints on free speech.
The termination of accounts also, I think, raises a big red flag, right? Like, you're compelling the social media company to take down speech, which is, I'm not an expert. You are, but the whole Section 230 aspect of what a publisher is and is obligated to do and isn't obligated to do or whatever seems like it's going to run afoul of that.
Oh, absolutely. And especially in today's day and age where you have influencers, you know, you have youngsters under the age of 18 that are actually bringing in income from things like this. Mm-hmm. No, I expect that there's going to be pushback probably from social media companies and families alike who will be affected by this. And it's hard because certainly there are a plethora of studies out there about the negative effects of social media on young minds. But, you know, it's going to be hard for lawmakers to come up with something that balances both First Amendment rights and the protections that we need for the youth.
Yeah, especially in light of the past couple of years when I would say that, you know, not to be overtly political, but the kind of cohort that is, or coalition rather, that is like behind this, if you will, has in many other contexts been all about the expansion of First Amendment rights for online speech. You know, the idea of doing something about, you know, quote unquote cancel culture or
right.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So like, and those are different things. You could definitely make big distinctions between the two things that I'm alluding to here, and you know what's going on with, you know, speech of minors, and minors also have limited speech rights compared to adults, sure, but nevertheless, this would amount to government down speech restrictions on individuals, minors, sure, from the same group of people that are like in other contexts, you know, we should be able to say anything online.
Right.
And it's just something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, no, it's definitely interesting. A lot of avenues that you can look at this one. So I'm sure that as soon as this starts to go into effect, there will be a slew of lawsuits. So we'll just have to keep an eye on it and see if Florida fares any better than California. All right, well, that's the show for today. Remember to check us out on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get your podcast. Leave us comments. Let us know your thoughts. If there's any other topics that you want us to cover or expand upon. And, yeah, we'll see you next time.